Canuck Central, Dan Riccio and Satyar Shah. I know people are wanting us to get in on the pregame, and we will in an hour's time as we get you set up for the Canucks and Edmonton Oilers. But it is Canuck Central. Continue to dive into the Canucks, some of the bigger trends that are going on with the team, and the latest report. Darren Dreger reporting. Patrick Alvin is looking like the next general manager of the Vancouver Canucks. Dreger is, as of right now, the only one on it, but he doesn't miss too often. So that is the latest with the Vancouver Canucks.
So, yeah, we'll see indeed if it is Patrick Alvin who's going to be the next general manager of the Vancouver Canucks. What a whirlwind day. First was Matthew Darche's name coming out. And what did we say? Never expect anything until it's announced or assume anything with Jim Rutherford. So that's where we're at.
Again, the tweet from Darren Dreger. From all accounts, it appears Patrick Alvin is about to become the next GM of the Vancouver Canucks. Not done yet, but getting closer. So that's where we are at. The name we heard most potentially could be that, but not official as of yet as Jim Rutherford continues to try and build out his front office. And as we know, it's not done there. There's still some other names that'll filter through. And as you mentioned yesterday, Sat, another woman could come on board. So there's still some other positions Jim Rutherford is looking at filling out here within the Canucks.
Yeah, so I think this week we'll still have a few more announcements coming up. Today, probably nothing happening because of the game going on. And nothing's been made official quite yet. But it's going to be an interesting week here. And, you know, the sense was the team wants to have all those ducks in a row by February. And I think what you're seeing now is kind of filling out the spots. And there'll be more to come after you get through the next couple weeks too, because one area to keep an eye on is going to be what happens with the amateur scouting side moving forward, right, Dan? Because what you're seeing now is Clancy comes in and he does a lot of scouting, more on the pro side, but, you know, does a bit of everything for this organization. And then you have Castron Gay, who's very clearly a
contract
CBA, but also as a former player agent understands how to build a culture and player development and all those sort of things. One thing they haven't yet hired is somebody with straight-up amateur expertise, right, as being, you know, the amateur guy. Now, the Canucks have a director of amateur scouting already in Todd Harvey, and I'm not suggesting he's at the risk of losing his job or whatever, but, you know, usually there's somebody else that comes in with a new front office in some sort of capacity, in some sort of a role. But is that something that may kind of come down a bit later? Because if I'm looking at, okay, what are you looking to add? I'd look at somebody with amateur scouting expertise. That would kind of seem like the type that they're missing as far as, you know, adding to the front office here a little bit. Now the question is that what gets what gets filled, or is that something that gets filled as you get past kind of the draft preps phase here? Because if you were trying to get some good amateur scouts or scouting directors, or want to give them a promotion or anything, it's hard to get them in season because teams want those guys to be taking care of their draft boards and everything. So to me, that's something that maybe happens as time goes on here. But, you know, Rutherford himself mentioned, Dan, they're not putting a cap on how many AGMs they're bringing in. So not suggesting there'll be redundancy in the type of AGM that comes in, but we might see somebody that may have some similar skill sets to what they already have in there.
So again, that report from Darren Dreger, Patrick Alvin is about to become the next GM of the Vancouver Canucks. Not done yet, but getting closer. That from Darren Dreger 11 minutes ago. We will continue to monitor and see if something bigger develops with that, and if something more official develops than Darren Dreger's recent reports. Dan Riccio and Satyar Shah. So, Canucks, looking at this team, Sat, we often look at where the holes are. The lotto line is being reunited for the time being. And yet the focus remains on how to reshape the roster, reshape it quickly. And it's hard to get around the defense and how you go about reshaping that area of the team. You know, it's not easy when you have as much money committed as the Canucks do on the back end right now in a flat cap world. How are you going to maneuver that? You might have to make some sideways trades if you're Jim Rutherford and the next GM of the Vancouver Canucks, whomever that may be, probably Patrick Alvin. But
yeah,
it's like that's really the primary concern here with this team and how it moves forward, because like, you have commitments and you're not getting enough results out of there. What do we talk about in the last hour? Efficiency. They're not the Canucks' biggest area of inefficiency is in its defense core.
Well, so much money is being invested, and only one player is giving you above surplus, and that is Quinn Hughes, right? Because everybody else, I mean, OEL's been good defensively. He's been good for the Canucks, but he's not excelling as far as being worth the over $7 million he's getting paid, right? Because he's not producing enough points with it. But he's played well. Myers, a similar conversation. He's been fine, but not $6 million good. Pullman, probably not $2.5 million good, or especially in having another 3 years on his contract. Similar thing with Hamonic, probably not worth the $3 million, right? So you build out that defense, there is a lot of inefficiency built on that blue line. And I do believe that's one thing the organization really wants to clean up here. Because we sit here and talk so much about, hey, you got to move it forward to address your defense. And in theory, that's your best way forward, right? Because you might have a surplus when it comes to forwards. You may not be able to keep everybody. So shift the money from that area to your back end. But that doesn't solve the fact that you have all these inefficient contracts on your back end. How do you find a way to get out from those? And one thing we talked about a little bit yesterday, but I would love to see them kind of do here is, can you move a guy for somebody else that's getting paid, but gives you a different skill set? Because I think right now, the biggest issue on this back end, Dan, beyond the fact that, they need to get better, the pieces just don't fit. They don't make sense, right? Like, Myers just makes no sense on this blue line. He's doing the best he can. I'm a fan of his, right? Like, I always defend him. But it's clear that him playing with OEL does not allow OEL to be more offensive. He's got to really stay back to let Myers go out and roam and do his thing, right? And he's at his best when he does that. But that doesn't allow OEL to be at his best. So how do you get OEL at his best? And can you get Myers at his best without OEL? And it's become very clear it's hard for Myers to be at his best unless he has a perfect partner. Well, if you're paying a guy $6 million and you're combining for almost $14 million on the cap for two players, it's hard for them to not fully complement and get the best out of each other, right? So I look at it and I say, as well as Myers has played, do you find a way to move him this offseason for another defenseman that may fit for your blue line a bit better, that allows other guys to fit in? Because outside of trading a forward, that's your only kind of bet here. Because Jack Rathbone, that's putting a lot of hopes on the guy. And as good as he is offensively and moves the puck and he'll fit the need that Boudreau talked about, he doesn't fit the need they have on the PK. He doesn't fit the need of defending in their own end. And that's how they have to reshape this blue line. Yes, you can trade a forward to do so, but how much of it can you reshape with the pieces you have already on your back end, but trying to get different types of players back in return?
It's one of the things that I've thought about a lot, but can you spend on defensemen that don't bring you any sort of offensive production or don't bring you enough offensive production? It's really difficult in this league. Like, I'm sorry, if you're paying a defenseman $7 million, there has to be some offensive production. Like, process is good, all those things are great, but like, there's got to be a bottom line there, right? And OEL, like, I've really liked his game. I've loved the defense that he's brought. I love watching him, even. The way some of the passes he makes are just mind-boggling. The one he made to Dickinson for the breakaway the other night, brilliant. He did it with Hoglander in the Nashville game where he's like looking one way and he finds a way to sneak the puck through the center of the ice to Nils Hoglander for a half break. Really impressive player. And I do think, even with the lack of production so far, that eventually it will start to come around to some level. But today's a good example. They have him and Quinn Hughes on power play one. They're trying to get OEL more offensive opportunities. You want to see some more bottom line out of that player, but he's just not able to do that with how their back end sets up. Now, does that make Myers more expendable than Tucker Pullman? Who knows what's going to happen with Travis Hamonic? Luke Shen has been a really good find for this team, but it really comes down to, I think, Myers and Pullman and what you do with those two players and how you go about potentially shifting one of their salaries for something else.
Because a lot of the things that Rutherford might be looking to do is, do you get like two or three of those guys together and try to make a deal for another team for a couple of guys? And you're essentially moving money around, but hey, you might end up with a better fit on your back end. I know we kind of talked about that yesterday, but that could be an avenue you kind of explore here to make your team better. Because you know, for a lot of the talk about the Canucks forward groups not scoring enough, I know Brandon Langley's mentioning that the biggest deficiency the Canucks have had right now is inability to score. They've scored more than 2 goals in only 15 games so far this season. That's totally true. But they're also not getting much of an offensive push from their back end. Now, I do think the defensemen probably need to get more points based on the rush chances that have been created off their passes and the chances the forwards haven't put in. But you also don't have any threat from the back end as far as scoring goes. Like, is there any player the Canucks have that makes the opposition think twice about that guy pinching in? Quinn Hughes, because of his vision and because of his playmaking ability and everything, but nobody's afraid of him shooting the puck when he comes in, right? So when teams are playing the Canucks, they have no fear of any defenseman pinching in and scoring any goals. And I think that is a bit of an issue. We can talk about the defense all forwards all we want and they can score more. I do think the defense has probably been better than people think as far as transitioning the puck. But when you don't have guys that can actually score from the back end and have that shot as being a threat, it does kind of change how teams play you. So they try to take the forwards away a bit more. And if you want to be a lot better defensively, you need to have guys that can score a bit. Because I go back to that 06-07 Canucks team. And they weren't the most loaded team. They had Luongo and Nett. They win the division that year, Luongo's first year. They go on a run past Christmas. But they had Olin, Bieksa, Salo on the back end. And that back end scored 45 goals that year.
Yeah.
You know, they were getting goals from those guys with point shots. They knew how to, like, Salo knew how to shoot. Olin was actually a good finisher. Bieksa did a decent job of scoring some of his chances, right? So you had this blue line that was able to score when they had the puck on their stick. There isn't a single player on this Canucks blue line that's been able to score. OEL should be that guy that can give you 10 to 15 goals, but he hasn't been. And we have no threat as far as a shot goes from your defenseman. That does pose a bit of an issue as well for your offense.
OEL, like, he finds ways to get pucks through, and he gets a lot of shots on net. I think he's, what, third or fourth on the team in total shots on goal this year? He's right there. And there's some nights where he leads the team in shots on goal. Now, it's maybe not a great thing, but you know, he does have a way of getting his shots on net, but is it a dangerous shot? Is it one that really frightens you like it did the year where he had 20?
Well, I think it's because of where the shots are coming from.
Yeah.
Because when you're playing with Myers, he's the guy that typically stays back a lot. Like, you don't often see, you know, OEL lead the rush or really get into the rush. Every once in a while you see it, but it's rare when they're playing together. So when all his shots are coming from the point, and you start looking at the goals he scored when he played in Arizona, especially on the power play, yeah, a lot of point shots, but there are also shots where he kind of would come in a little bit. And he would score off the rush quite a bit on even strength as well. You'd see him pinch and be more aggressive. You haven't quite seen that because of the role he plays here in Vancouver. So it kind of goes back to the conversation of not only are you looking to shift guys out and get better players back to fit you, but you also need to figure out a way to allow OEL to be the best version of himself. He's been a very competent version of himself. He's been very good defensively, but you haven't been able to really take advantage of his full skill set because of the way he's being asked to play.
And you have the same issue if you put Myers with Hughes. You know, like, I think in specialized situations, you can go to that pair. But you don't want to do it for an entire game, Hughes-Myers, right? You don't. So it's hard to separate or hard to get Myers away from OEL if you don't want to play him with Hughes, because then what are you playing him with on the third pair? And Travis had this same issue, you know, where you'd see, you know, you'd see Myers playing with whoever was the left shot D-man on the third pair. You know, whether that was Ben Hutton or whomever else, you know, was that guy. Ben Hutton's the wrong name I'm thinking of. But, you know, there was a long list of left shot D that Myers would play with on that third pair because you just didn't really know where else to play him. And I think that
Oscar Fantenberg.
Oscar Fantenberg is exactly who I was thinking of, the name escaping me. But it's been that way since he got here. And I don't know how you change that, you know?
Yeah.
Even if Myers and OEL have been fine, have been decent enough from a process standpoint at 5-on-5, it's just really difficult to live with that sort of a fit being so uncomfortable, really, for the team. And so what do you do? What's the pivot? And I don't know if I see one. You know, because even Pullman with OEL hasn't really worked out all that well. You know, Pullman is best served as a third pair D-man. And
well, they're lacking a top four guy, very clearly.
Hamonic hasn't worked out even in the few games that he's played this year. Shen's been the best fit of all the guys, you know?
Yeah, and the thing with Shen is, because he's on such a great value contract, and that's what Merrick mentioned, that he's a guy that teams are interested in. And yeah, he's good. He helps you out. But he's not really a bona fide top four guy. And if you're trying to win a Stanley Cup or you're trying to make a deep playoff push the next two years, this year and next year, then you don't move Luke Shen. Because, like, where else do you get $850,000 of value for a competent top six defenseman that can't play in your top four, can't play with Quinn Hughes? But if you're looking at this as being a 2 or 3 year thing, then do you not take advantage of the potential value of moving a guy like Luke Shen? So even him, a guy you talk about, he may not be a long-term solution here. It's more of a short-term solution, and his best value to your club might be moving him at the deadline, potentially, right? Depending on where you are as a team. So I think that's a bit of an issue. Now, obviously, if your top guys are scoring a bit more, we'd have a different conversation. And had OEL had a bit more puck luck, maybe we have a different combo. And that's what somebody texted in. You guys ever hear our shooting percentage?
Never heard of it.
But
that's here, a deep analytic, bro.
Very. But here's what I'll say, though. If you look at Oliver Ekman-Larsson's last 84 games, he's played 84 games last year and this year combined. Do you know how many points he has in those 84 games? 31. You know how many goals he has in those past 84 games?
Five.
Yeah. So this is more than just a bad luck sample. This is over a full year sample where a guy that normally has 15 to 20 goals is on pace for 4 goals this year, and last year was not on a better goal scoring pace. Now we have more points, but his shots are not quite as dangerous. Now, is it bad puck luck? Yes, to some degree. But I also believe, especially the Arizona team, with how these teams are playing and how they're playing behind, and he's the guy that stays back a bit more, he's not joining up as much. And we don't have him be as aggressive and let him be more offensively minded. He's not going to score as much. Yeah, I do think there will be some points coming for him. We talked about this. He's had a lot of bad luck, and especially assists for forwards that aren't finishing. That'll come. But if you really want to get OEL's offense to flourish, he's going to be allowed, or he's going to be on a deep pair that allows him to be more expansive in his play.
So, getting a couple of texts. And, if you're listening live, you can always text into the show 650-650 on the Dunbar Lumber text line. Love to see you participating in Canucks Central. And you can always send in questions if you listen on podcast for Mailbag Friday. Shoot us a DM on Twitter or to the text message inbox, but use a capital MF to label your question. This one is unsigned, but it mentions getting OEL more power play time. And we saw the setup right now. And look, the Canucks are very injury ravaged. They'll get Garland back on Thursday, Horvat back on Saturday. So whatever the power play looks like today certainly won't look like it by the weekend. But OEL and Hughes are lining up on the power play. At least that was the look at the game day skate. It is an interesting way to maybe get OEL more looks. It also might just be Bruce Boudreau saying, I'm going to get my 5 most talented players on the ice right now at the same time. And that's going to be the way we figure out the power play.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the way you got to approach it, especially now with guys going out. It's like, hey, maybe we could put somebody else up there, but why not just get OEL up there? And I actually like that. I mean, I like starting to see here OEL and Hughes on the same deep pair, right? And I think if you can get Hughes, not to say he's not a good quarterback, he is, but I almost want to see Quinn Hughes kind of come to the half wall every once in a while. I want to see him roam a bit more. I don't love seeing Hughes just be stationary at the point because his shot is not as big of a threat as it can be. But also, you're not fully using his speed, his skating ability, and his vision. Because if he's just standing up top, it's very limited what he can do. He walks the line, sure. He can make a pass to the right circle. He can make a pass to the left wall. But that's essentially all he has. If you can get him moving a bit more, get him to the half wall a little bit more, that opens up his vision, his ability to skate and maybe deke guys and get guys off their position a little bit. So I'm intrigued by having two defensemen to maybe get Quinn Hughes off the point at times. And getting that movement going, I think, can really kickstart things.
So much comes back to the movement thing, and it's been so frustrating how this unit can get so stationary at times, but maybe Hughes playing in a different spot than just at the top of it all starts to do that. Now, I also think I want to touch on the penalty kill for a minute here. It's been brutal again. They've given up goals in 7 straight games. A bunch of those games, it was the first goal against, so it started it 1-0, and the Canucks had to climb a hill to get back into it. With the way they're scoring right now, you know how difficult that is. They end up winning a couple of those games, Washington and Nashville anyways. But the penalty kill is, once again, a hindrance. And they need to figure it out. But when we talk about the D and how it's built and how it's clunky, how it doesn't make a ton of sense with the types of players that are on it, how much does that play into the penalty kill, where OEL has been the stalwart? Myers, you know, is not the best penalty killer. He's forced into playing big minutes on the penalty kill with this team. Pullman has left some to be desired for me on the penalty kill, and certainly that showed the other night with the Shen goal. But they only have, essentially, Hughes and OEL are their two left-shot D-men that they've been using on the penalty kill. And Hughes, I don't think you want to use him all the time on the penalty kill anyhow. Rathbone is your next guy on the left side. Brad Hunt, like all of the guys on the left side, are not penalty killers. Or not traditional penalty killers. I'm not saying you have to have those guys, but it's a bit weird, you know? And you end up seeing the Canucks with like four right shot guys playing D on defense, on the PK.
Again, it's just the pieces, right, that have to fit a lot better. Yeah. So you look at this team, and I think you look at the forward group, you look at some of the defense, and the collection of talent is there in so many different ways. And I don't think the tweaks necessarily need to be that grand for this team to really take that next step. But it gets complicated by the fact of the whole situation with JT Miller, right? What do you do with Brock Besser? I think those are the things that kind of impacted. Yeah. But I look at the back end, and as much as, yes, they have some issues, I also view it as shifting some stuff around can really change the outlook there. And you look at teams around the league, the type of blue lines they have, oftentimes it's not even so much about them having great blue lines, it's about how functional they can be and how they work together with their system they play, and also the personnel you have and the roles they can play. And that's been the biggest issue here as far as the back end for the Canucks goes, I think.
I think Boston is the best example of that. Like they find guys. It's like plug and play. Mike Riley, sure, go ahead, have a great season because you're a Boston Bruin. Matt Grizzlick, yeah, you're going to be a great top-end defenseman because you're a Boston Bruin now. Of course, Charlie McAvoy is supremely talented, and maybe, you know, Grizzlick is a guy that was not looked at enough on the come-up, but you know, they've developed him into a very good defenseman. Brandon Carlo has worked out well for them. And there's other examples around the league. You know, Zach Whitecloud in Vegas. Where did they get him from? You know, it's not always the most obvious guys that end up filling a very good role for you on the back end and leading to team success. And that's the type of difficulty that the Canucks front office will have to figure out in the next little while. All right, it's Dan Riccio and Satyar Shah. Irfan Ghaffar, Canucks insider at the fourth period, will join us next. It is Canucks Central. Back in on Canucks Central, final segment, Dan Riccio and Satyar Shah. At the top of the hour, Canucks Central pregame will begin with us getting you ready for the Edmonton Oilers in town tonight. And a couple of things going on as the Canucks try to get back closer to health, but Tanner Pearson went into COVID protocol today. Now the 20th player since, I think, just before Christmas that has gone through COVID protocol for the Vancouver Canucks. It's unfortunate, as Bruce mentioned today, like none of these players are actually getting sick. JT Miller will be back in the lineup tonight. Thatcher Demko is still in protocol. Halak Garland should be back Thursday in Winnipeg, and Bo Horvat Saturday in Calgary. Look, it's never a good situation, no matter how it happens, but you almost wonder if, similar to Calgary or Edmonton this year, you just your whole team goes through it and that's it. Whereas for the Canucks, it's just been like one or two players every couple of days. So it's kind of been staggered the whole season through.
Yeah, it has been. And, you know, the hope is once you kind of get through this and you know, you'll have less of these players come positive because so many of them got it at this point on this team this year. And with the rules changing coming up in February, maybe after the All-Star break, things help. But, you know, every team, I know Jeffro is very frustrated. He says every team has dealt with this to some degree. Some teams have had it really, really bad, and some teams maybe not quite as bad. It's been really inconsistent for the Canucks, or I guess it has been consistent, one or two guys every other day, it seems like, going into protocol. But there have been a number of teams that have been hit very, very hard this season as well. It's not just a Canucks thing.
Yeah, and it's just hit really hard to the top of their roster over the last couple of games and affected it. All right, Dan Riccio, Satyar Shah. Let's bring in our next guest, insider. At the fourth period, it's Irfan Ghaffar. What's up, Irf?
What's going on, fellas? How you doing?
We're all right. It seems as though a lot is happening with the Canucks front office. Patrick Alvin, mentioned by Darren Dreger, looks to be the next Canucks GM. What do you know? It's been a lot of information kind of flying all over the place, but Dreger usually doesn't miss on these types of things.
Yeah, and it's been one of those things where it's kind of been all over the place, right? You haven't really seen much of a leak or anything like that over the last couple of weeks, ever since really then Jim Rutherford took over, as to kind of what's been going on and with their hires and who is getting filled in where. And, you know, I think that that name in the beginning, Alvin, was one that a lot of people thought, and a lot of people made reference to it because of their time spent in Pittsburgh and things like that. But if Dreger's reporting it, I'm pretty sure, you know, he usually doesn't miss. But I do know they interviewed a bunch of candidates, and you know, some interviews went a lot better than others. But you know, this decision at the end ultimately is completely up to Jim Rutherford, and I do know that for sure. So if it is him and this is his guy and this is someone that he trusts and he's worked with and he's familiar with, then, you know, it's probably a good thing for this organization. So we'll just wait and kind of see what happens. But, you know, if the name's already getting thrown out and things like that, you're probably going to see something come out officially in the next day or two.
Well, and it certainly seems that way, like this week, and that's kind of been the buzz, that by the end of this week, if not by tomorrow or so, we'll have an official announcement on who the GM is going to be. But there might be more, too, right? And there's been talk of another woman potentially getting hired. And, you know, as much as we're sitting here talking about the GM, like, there's still a lot of work to be done here. And I wouldn't be surprised that even if we see a woman get hired and Rutherford gets his GM, then we may not see other things in a couple of months as well.
Yeah, Sat, you and I talked earlier today, obviously not on the air, but we were talking about, you know, things of that nature. And are we going to see a complete overhaul of maybe the scouting department and what happens there? And, you know, that probably gets pushed further along down the road towards the draft, I would say. But what we do know is that Jim Rutherford wants to have his people in place well before the trade deadline. He wants to get a strong evaluation of what he believes and what his team underneath believes that this team needs. On the ice and things like that. And you obviously saw, and we hear about the trade rumors involving JT Miller and things like that, and, you know, untouchables on the roster. Obviously Pettersson, Demko, and Quinn Hughes are those three names that, you know, potentially are a no-fly zone for the Canucks management right now. But when you look at it, as long as Rutherford has his team in place and things like that, and it happens very quickly here, I think we can start to see some movement in other avenues, whether that involves a trade or signings or things like that. So it's going to be an interesting next couple of weeks here for the Vancouver Canucks. I know this is a results-driven business, but at some point, you know, the results for Jim Rutherford might not mean anything because he knows what this team needs or what it doesn't need.
Well, you know, I think it's hard to judge this team on the last few games that they've played, right?
Yeah.
You know, with all the players out and the goaltending situation, it's been difficult to say the least. And you know what, they've still acquitted themselves pretty well, and they've put out some really strong efforts, even in losing causes. But you know, even through the big win streak to start Boudreaux's career and the relative success that this team has had since the changeover, doesn't feel like this current management group is, you know, swayed by it at all. They still see that there's a lot of work to be done on this roster to get it to where it needs to go. And, you know, maybe not at the deadline, but there's some big moves that are here to be made.
Yeah. I mean, I think anyone can look at this roster and say there's a lot of work that needs to be done, to be completely honest, right? And I just think that now, you have the people in place that are willing to go out and put their necks on the line and try and improve this hockey team in the right way, right? And they're going to, you know what, there might be mistakes that are made, and it might be things that happen that, you know, fans don't like and things that of that nature. But at the same time, ownership is putting its trust into this group and into Jim Rutherford and whoever he decides to hire to make these moves and to make this team, you know, go back to being a contender for a playoff spot and then hopefully, you know, be a contender to win a round and then go from there. Because I don't think you can build a contender overnight. You look at a lot of teams in the National Hockey League, how long it's taken to build and how long it's taken to get them to where they need to go. The Tampa Bay Lightning, prime example, right, of teams that were just getting there, and then you see them win back-to-back, you know, cups because of their depth, because of moves that were made by their GM and things of that nature. So we'll see what happens here, but I wouldn't be shocked if moves that were made were pretty drastic, and it's one of those things that there's a reason why ownership brought in who they did.
Well, and you know, some the interesting thing is going to be timeline, right? Like,
yep.
How much does the playoff race really matter here? I know from an organization standpoint, they would love to have the chance to make the postseason. But as far as making those big moves go, do you think Rutherford is waiting to see what the standings are, or he's just kind of waiting for the right opportunity to make that deal?
I think, look, I don't think the Canucks are going to completely blow it up here. He said the other day that, you know, we want to win hockey games. You know, they're not going to come in here and completely blow it up and gut it and just for the sake of getting rid of salary and players and things like that. I think you, like I've said before, you make trades and you make moves to improve your hockey team down the road. And you need to take into consideration that you're going to have Elias Pettersson, Quinn Hughes, Thatcher Demko. You know, when you re-sign Bo Horvat, if Brock Besser remains as a Vancouver Canuck, you have these players for a considerable amount of time, and you have to attack while their window is open. So who are you going to surround these players with? Because right now, if you look at the bottom nine, the bottom nine after the lotto line for tonight's game, I know everyone's out and it's COVID and things like that, but, you know, you're going to need a lot more depth than that to compete, especially at this level.
Yeah, and you see it in some of the top teams.
Yeah,
with especially Florida, the amount of scoring depth that they have is really impressive. You know, the name that won't go away is JT Miller, and
yeah.
We've heard now up to four teams. You know, the Rangers, the Wild, the Bruins, the Flames. Frank Saravalli mentioning those names, those teams on our show yesterday. It's look. It's no secret that contenders would want JT Miller. I guess it just comes down to whether that's a deadline move or a summertime move. But just it feels like this conversation isn't going away, Irf, unless he signs an extension or they actually move him.
Yeah, and it's not going to. And yeah. it's gonna get to a point where we're gonna be talking about it like we are every single day until something happens, right? And I think for JT Miller and for the Vancouver Canucks, you know, there has to be some sort of discussion that's happening there with his camp. It's, are we going to move forward and try and work out an extension? Do you see yourself being a part of the solution in the next couple of years? And what does that number look like? And I think that's the biggest thing for this organization is what does that number look like? Because if you're deciding on trying to keep Bo Horvat as your captain, then how much money is left for JT Miller? And I think that's where the answer right now lies. If we keep hearing this name of JT Miller, you know, being involved in trade rumors, the decision's probably made that, you know, Bo's your guy, and Bo's the guy that you're going to keep, right? Especially because you're probably going to get him for less than Elias Pettersson money, you know, on probably a 5 or 6 year deal for Bo Horvat. So, and because he's the captain of your team, I just think that, you know, that decision is relatively easy to make. And right now, you kind of have to strike while the iron's hot and see what's happening and what teams are willing to pay for a guy like JT Miller. And I think that's the biggest thing. If there's an offer that's good enough, and Jim Rutherford likes it, as of tomorrow morning, if some team calls, I wouldn't be surprised if he decided to make a deal. But obviously things like this do take time. There's a reason why we hear these names and these teams, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. So it's one of those things that's going to be interesting to keep an eye on for sure.
We know Rutherford has mentioned, you know, wanting to get younger, wanting to get more draft picks. But do you think a Miller trade is solely for futures?
I don't know. I think that you probably have to have a player in return at some point. I know we've talked about it, you know, obviously offline, you know, is it a first round pick and something, or is it Miller and someone for a player and a prospect and things like that. So you have to look at everything into consideration here, right? Because you know, Miller's on a pretty friendly contract for the next season as well. So if you think you're a team that's going to be a contender, and not only this year, but next year as well, and you can get him for what he's making right now, I think that you'd be stupid to not try and go and, you know, acquire his services. And I think that that's what the teams that believe that they're contenders, or believe that they're teams that are going to contend in the next couple of years, you know, you just mentioned the names, the Rangers, the Wild, the Blues, and the Flames. If they believe that, you know, they're there in the next couple of years, why not try and, you know, shoot a home run and get JT Miller?
The question, too, about JT is there any way they can find a way to keep him? Or is this simply a question of he may not want to be here beyond next season?
I think it's a matter of dollars, to be completely honest, right? You just look at the math. How much is Brock Besser going to make? How much is Bo Horvat going to make? And are they going to have enough room to keep JT Miller? And then on top of that, you have to improve your defense. You have to, whether it's via trade, whether it's a free agent signing, whether it's one of those avenues, you have to improve the defense a little bit.
Yeah,
right?
But they've got to move salary off that D2 then.
Well, exactly. And I mentioned, whether it's via trade, right? So I think it's one of those things where you look at it, and I don't know if JT doesn't want to be here. I think he does enjoy his time here. He sees the potential here, but, you know, he's a guy that's, you know, a little bit older right now, and he's obviously thinking about his family, and then maybe, you know, he's a guy that does want a big contract and things like that. So we'll see what happens here. Again, like I said, it's going to be an interesting thing to keep an eye on, but if his name's out here this early before the trade down, then you definitely know there's something going on.
Well, and even beyond that, Irv, when you look at guys that could get traded and guys that won't get traded, and I know we talked about this too the last couple of days, but like outside of Hughes, Pettersson, and Demko, is there anybody you look at and say, yeah, there's no chance they get traded, or could, you know, everybody's kind of available outside of those three?
If you want to improve your hockey team and you're really serious about doing it, you figure out who your core pieces are, and they've done that with Hughes, Pettersson, and Demko, and you know, right now you have some nice pieces around them, but you have to try and surround those three key core players with guys that are going to come in and be able to compete and help this team move to a better position and to hopefully compete in the playoffs. And I think that that's the biggest thing. And for Jim Rutherford, to be completely honest, he doesn't owe any of these guys anything. We didn't draft really any of them, right? And he's got no, there's no, I don't want to say there's no loyalty. It's probably not the word I'm looking for, but he doesn't really owe anyone anything. So for him to trade a player, it's not like, okay, I traded my fifth-round draft pick or I traded my fifth overall pick. It's not anything like that. He's going to make moves, or the next GM that's going to come in and make moves to help this team win hockey games.
Irv, we appreciate the time as always, man. Thank you.
What you got this weekend? What a weekend of football.
Oh, man.
I know, you guys brought me on too early. I thought you were going to get me on Friday, and we just talk about football the whole time.
I'm going pure chalk, man, like Kansas City and L.A.
I like the Bengals to cover.
Yes.
And maybe buy a couple points at like six.
The Niners seem to have the Rams' number, though. That might be the
case. Yeah, but Garoppolo stinks.
I know, but that's they still beat them twice this year with
I
Jimmy
know.
G.
Garoppolo beat Aaron Rodgers without even scoring a touchdown. Like, that's how bad he is.
I think the Rams are a different team right now than they were in the season.
Oh, Rams are good. And the Rams have, like Odell Beckham Jr. is a different Odell Beckham Jr. Von Miller is now the Von Miller that, you know, was there when Peyton Manning won Peyton Manning a Super Bowl. Like, they're playing some good football. And Aaron Donald, obviously, probably the number one best player in the NFL. But, yeah, I probably got Rams in that game, too.
See, Odell's basically playing for free because he's getting paid in Bitcoin or something.
It's only worth like 30 grand right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that Super Bowl ring, it's going to feel so much sweeter.
Yeah. And he's still getting paid by the Browns, so I think he'll be
okay.
Paid
by Sat-T.
I guess so, Odell will be fine.
Such a nice conversation. You had to bring that up.
Man. So depressing.
All right,
buddy.
All right, see you. There he is. One of the best guys around. He is Irfan Ghaffar, covering the Canucks with the fourth period.
Yeah, and, you know, it's fascinating talking to Irf about, you know, and he mentions drastic things could happen as time goes on here. Maybe we see this team do something significant here. And potentially, right? I mean, we're in a spot here now with Rutherford at the helm where anything can kind of happen. And, you know, the thing I find interesting here is, how does this organization view some of their younger players? And I mean Nils Höglander and Vasily Podkolzin. And before anybody gets any thoughts of me talking about trading them, that's not the point I'm making. It's more about how do they view those guys as pieces short term, long term, how they fit, how the coach is utilizing them? And because we talk so much about, okay, you have these bigger guys, right? But what about the other guys that are coming up through the lineup that are on cheaper contracts that can supplement this team a little bit? How do you feel about those guys? Like, what do you do with them? And how do they kind of fit in with the big picture here? Because, you know, over the spell where guys have been injured and guys have been out with COVID, neither guy, Hoglander nor Putkolzin, has really been able to emerge through this last few games. Like, even Putkolzin's minutes have kind of gone down. We talked so much earlier about how Boudreau was showing perhaps a bit more confidence in Putkolzin's game, and we talked so much about Hoglander and some of the criticism. But, you know, Putkolzin's now been playing a bit less. Like, he's down under 9 minutes at times, under 10 minutes at times in recent games and stuff like that. And, hey, it's early. He's a rookie. It's part of the progress and development and everything like that. But I think, you know, under the previous regime, they were very much seen as guys that are untouchable, guys that we don't move. We're building here as part of the core moving forward. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how the coach uses these guys the rest of the season and how they kind of slot in under this regime.
I think they are incredibly important and valuable pieces to the short-term future of this team because of their contract situations and because of the value you could potentially get on their deals. Should they, you know, take progressive steps forward with their game, I would explore a long-term deal with Nils Hoglander in the summer. You know, of course there's other more pertinent things you have to do this summer, but, you know, maybe that's something the Canucks could look at, you know. A four-year deal at a very manageable number, $2.5-3 million, whatever it kind of looks like, and it kicks in after next season, and you have Nils Hoglander at a number you know that you're comfortable with, and you know, that's a more efficient way of looking at his contract than giving somebody out of free agency that's 28, 29, $3 million a year.
And one of the things that happened with this team prior, they made the wrong bets on those guys on their second contract. Yeah. You saw it with Sven Bierchi's deal. Yeah. You saw it with Ben Hutton, too, right? Even Troy Stetcher. Troy Stetcher gets priced out because of his qualifying offer. It was over $2.5 million. He signs for 1.7 with the Red Wings. So a lot of the contracts they gave out before were too much for the guys, and they didn't live up to it. And at that point, they become an asset you can't do anything with. You can't even trade those guys. Yeah. They have no value at that point. So before you give that second contract out, especially if you're giving a little bit of term on it, you got to make sure there's some risk there. You got to make sure you give out the right ones, because under the previous regime, they got almost all those second contracts wrong, outside of the obvious ones like Brock Besser and some of the higher end guys.
It's really an inefficiency that people don't bring up enough. We mostly just focus on the Beagles and Roussels of the world, but you know, that part of it was really apparent too. But like, I just think those contracts are so valuable to this team moving forward, but they have to progress those players. One thing I think about Putkolzin and his game right now, you know, because of the lack of depth within the Canucks forward group, given all of the absences, you know, he doesn't get sheltered as much when he's playing with Sheldon Dries and Justin Bailey, right? It's you're not getting you're not the third guy on a line. Your mistakes are more apparent because there isn't Bo Horvat covering for you, or even a Jason Dickinson, who's a very responsible center in that sense. So I think there's a lot to think about when you look at how the lines are shaking out, and Podkolzin's probably been the biggest, one to suffer out of the COVID absences. Hoglander, I like him so much as a player, and I know there's some raw, like, his game just hasn't developed on the defensive side of the puck as much as you would have liked it to. Now, almost, you know, a season and a half through his NHL career, but I just think the value of that player, should he figure that side out, is so big that it could really help this team long term.
Yeah, and that's the thing, right? And if you're able to hit the ceiling on these guys, or if you're able to get the most out of these guys, that's where that next level comes in, and that's what I'm so intrigued by. And, it, you know, when you look at this management team, too, It also looks at where are your inefficiencies, like you mentioned before, and what's your best way to get that out of a player, and how do you kind of hit big on guys? And that's going to be the next part of this evolution here, too, is, okay, you can talk about trading this guy, trading that guy, and the big guys you got to sign and figure out. But what about everybody else? How do they slot in, and how can you maximize those guys moving forward, right? And I think that's going to be a big part of it, and that's why I find it so intriguing, especially under Boudreaux. What does Hoeglander do the rest of the season? How does Putkolzin emerge? And how do these guys kind of slot in under this new regime? Because if you're looking for your biggest jump, it's right. It's those guys on those entry-level contracts that can make that bump if they can take that leap.
It is Canuck Central. We're back tomorrow. A full program. Kevin Woodley will be joining us, our goalie guru, on the goalie situation that's gone on here in Vancouver. But the pregame is next. Edmonton Oilers in town. We'll welcome in the roundtable next on Sportsnet 650.